Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to On the Couch with Dr. Michelle, right here on LA Talk Radio.
This is Dr. Michelle Cohen, and you are officially on the couch here, as you always are, Friday afternoons. Well, it's afternoon to me. 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time. here in beautiful Los Angeles, where you can learn so much about why people do the things they do. Or, you know, just understand yourself a little bit better. And that's what we're talking about today, as we always do. But more important, which I think a lot of people need to understand, is what's behind the mind of many people who are diagnosed with particular types of mental illness. Why is that such a stigma? And what are people afraid of? You know, if you looked at my social media PR pages today, this was one of the main themes that I was putting out there. It's why are people so, you know, freaked out about the concept of a mental illness. It's like any other kind of illness. I try to explain to a lot of people I see, having a bipolar diagnosis or a major depressive disorder or, you know, many other OCDs, other problems, it's very difficult. But there are certainly wonderful medications out there that can help manage these symptoms. It's just like having a medical diagnosis of, say, diabetes. You have to take your medication every day, you know, or you have heart issues, you've had surgeries, you've got to take your Plavix or whatever you're taking every day in order to maintain a certain, you know, lifestyle and health. But we're going to delve more into that today. And we're also going to talk about a lot of other cool things, too, with one of my favorite guests, who is an amazing author. He writes novels, novellas, been published in so many journals. Actually, one of my favorite psychiatrists, I would say, actually, Dr. Mark Rubenstein. And you've heard him on the show before, guys. In addition to running his psychiatric private practice, he developed an interest in forensic psychiatry. And he's taught psychiatric residents, interns, psychologists, and social workers at a New York Presbyterian hospital. He became a clinical assistant professor at Cornell University's medical school. And, of course, as I mentioned, Dr. Rubenstein is professionally published in journals. He's always writing articles and has always written some amazing books. We've talked about him on the air here. So let me go down some of the list, if I may, just to give you guys a little idea here of some of the fiction and nonfiction books. So we've talked about Mad Doghouse, Love Gone Mad, The Foot Soldier, Mad Dog Justice. Ooh, I like that one. Return to Sandara, The Lover's Tango, and also Bedlam's Door, True Tales of Madness and Hope, and of course, the part two, Bedlam's Door, which is really amazing. And by the way, Mark, so nice to have you on the phone with me here. Thanks. I'm yakking so much this morning, I should give you a chance to say hi.
Well, hi, Dr. Michelle. It's great to be on the air with you. It always is. Oh. I always enjoy our conversations.
Well, me too. You know that, boy. And thank you for taking the time out to be with me this morning, this afternoon.
My pleasure.
Yeah, it's this afternoon for you, isn't it? You know. So you have been up for a lot of awards lately. I don't doubt it. Let's see. The Audible version, right, of Beyond Bedlam's Door. It was a finals in the Indies Awards, right?
That's going to be decided in June, but Yay. It's one of five finalists for the, I think they call it the Indy Fab Awards,
nice.
Sponsored by the American Library Association, and it's an honor just to be nominated, so, I'm waiting to see what happens in June.
Oh, that's wonderful. And the Lover's Tango was winner of the 2016 Benjamin Franklin Popular Fiction Award. Didn't that get that award, too? Gosh.
Yeah, it won the gold, and I've lost track of the awards. I know it sounds grandiose.
Oh, that's great.
To put it that
but
way,
for you.
But I don't follow these things anymore. I just write.
Yeah, well, good for you. That's the way to look at it, I guess.
Yeah.
And you know what I really am so amazed about with you is that your strength of work, you know, and your storytelling ability. You're such a great novelist, and you're a medical doctor. So you have the scientific part of the brain that's brilliant, and you also have that creative part of your brain. A lot of people aren't pumping on both sides like that, but you put it all together so you can just make these magic stories that are compelling, and yet a lot of them are based on medical information, so...
Yeah, well, you know, every patient has a story to tell, and do you remember the old, back years ago, there used to be a program on television called The Naked City?
Oh, yeah.
And it was a crime, detective kind of thing, and the introduction always said, there are 8 million stories in The Naked City, you know.
That's right.
And that's what I always found fascinating about psychiatry. You can have 100 patients with 100 different symptoms and problems and different lives, and each of them has a unique story to tell.
Boy, is that for sure. And I always, that's probably, you just answered my next question, but I wanted to ask, what made you go into forensic psychiatry?
I was practicing a general psychiatry, adult psychiatry, and it was everything I'd hoped it would be. I was always fascinated by stories and storytelling, and what always gripped me was the fact that, going back to 20 different people, let's say, who have... a variety of they could let's say you took 20 people who had the same diagnosis of let's just say major depression. Those 20 people will still have 20 different stories, amazing stories to tell if you listen.
Yes.
And if you're receptive to what they're saying about their lives and their conflicts. And I always found that very gratifying, depression, of course, being a almost uniformly, when I say easy, I mean it's such a treatable disorder because of medications these days, which I might add is always better to treat with psychotherapy.
Yes.
And a combination if the medication is warranted. But forensic psychiatry, I happened upon it by accident simply because I wrote a report for the Bureau of Disability Determinations, the state of New York, and some attorney, I don't know, got a hold of it, and he said, gee, this is a great report. You really captured what this person's all about, and I'd like to refer someone to you who's involved in litigation. And it was a person who had been injured in an accident and had apparently developed a depression because of various limitations that followed on the heels of that injury. So I wrote a report, and, you know, within about 6 months to a year, I began getting more and more referrals, and I found that forensic psychiatry took me out of the realm of office psychiatry and even of hospital psychiatry because I was encountering people who'd been involved in terrible accidents in situations that oftentimes were beyond the realm of ordinary circumstances, people who had been victims of crime of one kind or another and who were seeking redress, either suing a landlord or where negligence had been involved and an explosion had occurred in a building. I was seeing and meeting people and interviewing them and learning more and more about PTSD and about people who really were in extremis.
Yes.
The kinds of things you don't see really in a usual, regular, ordinary kind of office practice. So it really became a way for me of blending in the relatively ordinary with that which was extraordinary, and it really rounded out my experiences. I just found it fascinating. Then, of course, there was the challenge of dealing with courtrooms and testifying and getting cross-examined.
Oh, my gosh.
you know, it was like going through the the Dante's ninth level of hell, but after a while you become pretty good at it. You learn how to think on your feet, and I guess it also appealed to a certain combative part of my nature, because there was nothing as exhilarating as being cross-examined. And when an attorney was cross-examining me, the attorney was cross-examining me about psychiatry, and he or she was, they were out of their field, they were in my field. And it was pretty easy to deal with the questions they asked. And after a while, their questions, after a year or so of it, the questions became pretty expectable and routine.
Right.
And, I learned how to handle them. It was another experience in life.
Exactly. It is a fascinating experience when the attorneys really question your expertise and try to, I don't know, they're very clever with words and the way they say things. And you just look at them like, do you think how crazy or dumb do you think I am? I mean,
isn't it true, doctor, that psychiatry and psychology are the least scientific specialties in all of medicine and in all of healthcare? And that was a typical question.
Yes.
And, I would respond with, it may appear unscientific to you, but incredible advances are being made now in neurochemistry, biochemistry, in medications, in new forms of therapy, and the future of all of medicine rests on scientific foundations, including psychiatry, no, it's not true.
Beautiful. You got that one down. That's great. Oh, I love it. Guys, in case you just tuned in here, you're on the couch with Michelle. That's me, my special guest today, Dr. Mark Rubenstein. He is an amazing psychiatrist. He runs his private practice, developed interest in forensic psychiatry, is an expert, taught psychiatric residents, interned psychologist in New York Presbyterian Hospital, and of course became a clinical assistant professor at Cornell University's Medical School. You've done it all, Mark. My gosh. This is...
Well, not quite all, but, I've been around now. It's been a while, and I've been around.
There you go. And a lot of the books, by the way, that we touch on today, folks, you can look at and purchase and just read and enjoy, because they're fascinating. Not only are they a nonfiction, but they're fiction as well, and they're compelling stories of vengeance and thrillers and mysteries and homicides. Ooh, all that cool stuff. Why do you think people are so fascinated with those shows, Mark, that are on TV on the Discovery Channel and other such, whodunit programs that are reality-based?
It's sort of the old maxim, why do people rubberneck as they pass an accident scene on the highway? Even though they've been held up for a half hour and traffic is moving at a snail's pace, they still slow down as they're passing the accident scene. They rubberneck, they look. I think people are essentially fascinated by the macabre, by the unusual, by that which is beyond the realm of the ordinary. Not only that, we all, why do people go to horror movies and read Stephen King's books and things like that? We all want to be frightened, but under controlled circumstances. It's only a story. It's only a book. It's only a movie. I think there is a fascination with that, and especially when it's true life, when things are, whether it's about John Gotti or some other mafioso or about Russian oligarchs or whatever.
Yes.
What we encounter are people who are operating on the edge. I'll never forget once in a conversation with Michael Connelly.
Yes.
He and I were sitting at a table, and we were talking about thrillers and about suspense. Mm-hmm. And there was an audience in front. So we were each drinking water. We each had a glass. And he said, well, let me tell you about suspense. And he took his glass and he put it in the middle of the table. He said, is there anything suspenseful about that? And, you know, the audience, including me, said, no, nothing particularly.
Yes.
And then he began moving it slowly toward the edge of the table. And it got closer and closer until about a quarter of the bottom of the glass was hanging over the edge but had not yet tipped.
Yes.
And he said, well, now are you waiting in suspense to see what will happen? And the answer was a resounding yes. He said, things that are close to the edge, where there's danger,
yes,
where there's the expected but unexpected, mm-hmm, where there's the horrific, always are more compelling than the ordinary.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, what really attracts people.
Yes.
We all want to try to understand the horror that can occur in life.
Yes.
We want to get a better handle, I think, on the unusual, on the mm-hmm frightening. And if we can do it under controlled circumstances, namely
right,
watching a movie mm-hmm or watching a television documentary about these kinds of things, as long as it's not happening to us,
yes,
we're content.
Yes, exactly. So maybe also, like you said, it's sort of dipping our toe into that like little pool of fear. It's almost like exposure therapy. We can expose ourselves.
Yeah, it's like riding the roller coaster at an amusement park. I mean, people do it. They get scared out of their wits. They scream. And if you've ever been on some of the big roller coasters, they are, your stomach is 40 feet above your head, on that down sweep. And it really can be very frightening, but it's controlled. And it's the same principle, I think. So these things fascinate us. We fear them, but just a bit. As long as they're not real.
Right. I agree with you. It makes so mm-hmm much sense. So what is it about mental illness, you know, that scares so many people, do you think? Is it the lack of control, possibly?
I think it's seeing people. First of all, people don't understand much about mental illness. What mm-hmm they see are the bizarre manifestations of mental illness, that is, of severe mental illness,
people
who are schizophrenic or really psychotic and agitated.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, there are mental disorders my God, if you just ride on a bus walk down a street, who knows how many people are deeply troubled and could be legitimately diagnosed as suffering from some kind of emotional or mental disorder, be it depression or a low-level smoldering depression or obsessive compulsive disorder or just genuine human unhappiness.
Yes.
So, it encompasses really the bulk of humanity, but the more extreme manifestations can be very frightening to see, especially if you don't understand them.
Yes.
And then there's the media always pick up on the relatively rare cases of psychopathology that are accompanied by extreme violence. The paranoid schizophrenic who seizes an AR-15 and mows down 30 people. The James Holmes in Aurora, Colorado. The Adam Lanza in Newtown, Connecticut. These, of course, attract enormous media attention, and people develop a sense that those who are mentally unstable, those who have extreme psychopathology, mm-hmm, are indeed violent, and that scares them.
Oh, yeah.
The real, if you do an epidemiologic study, mm-hmm, you realize that less than one half of 1% of schizophrenic people, which mm-hmm is the most severe form of psychopathology, less than one half of 1% of those people are truly violent.
Right.
So, a lot of it is based, a lot of the fear is based on misinformation, on no information.
Mm-hmm.
It's based on the bizarreness of some of the people you see who are extremely disturbed.
Right.
And it's really not founded. And of course, the police are often not very well trained in this kind of thing either. And we all too often read about police shooting down someone who is disturbed, but who could be easily controlled with a taser or just physically overwhelmed by two or three officers. But they get scared, and they've been trained to react in a certain way. It's really based on misapprehension and misconception.
I agree. I think, you know, police can't do it all. They really can't. I mean, I don't know how anyone could do that particular job and be, you know, super excellent at it, because, you know, you're using the old brain, you're using the intuition, you're using the rules. There's so much going on in regards to saving themselves and others as well. You know, I think it would be really difficult, but I do agree that there needs to be a lot more education for
the limbic system of the brain is activated in these extreme situations, and there's very little time to think. Mm-hmm. And in New York City now, they're very actively discussing and probably going to very soon implement a program of having trained social workers accompanying the police on domestic calls, particularly when there are reports of violence or someone who has a known history of a mental disorder. So that may help also.
Oh, that's a great idea. I did a couple of those ride-alongs here with the LAPD. Because I worked with them, and not in an official capacity, but from time to time I'd go in some of these domestic situations. And, you know, there was usually substance abuse going on. So it was just but it was fascinating to me, you know, to sort of try to cool down the situation and make everything nice, and somehow, and not to be sexist, but somehow when you have a woman therapist sort of entering the environment and with a calming voice saying, okay, now, you know, rather than uniformed cops, many times male, it does help sometimes. So I think that's a cool program.
Sexist at all. I mean, many agitated men will become much less so in the presence of a soothing woman whom they view, whether rightly or wrongly, as being far less threatening.
Right.
You know, a big burly guy with a gun strapped to his hip, you know, and a billy club can look extremely threatening, whereas a woman unarmed will be perceived probably as much less so, and the person will become more responsive.
Well, I'd love to find out more about some of the, you know, I'm always digging into your brain about some of the most fascinating stories and situations that you have experienced and people that you write about in your books. So can you share, especially in Bedlam's Door, True Tales of Madness and Hope, and Beyond Bedlam's Door, you have those chapters broken down into various case studies, and then there's a glossary of terms, which is amazing because a lot of people, you know, can really understand more about what you're talking about. So what are just a few of the most fascinating cases that you've dealt with?
Well, two stand out in my mind. One is they're both from Beyond Bedlam's Door. They really were much more part of my private practice, although one of them was forensic. In one, I received a call from an attorney. Would I be willing to evaluate his client who was suing his psychiatrist? The psychiatrist is being sued for malpractice. It turned out that the psychiatrist, and this all became evident because I read records, and there was a criminal case going on along with the civil case. The genesis of it was as follows. This fellow, the patient, the man who was suing, had severe panic disorder, and he was working out of his garage, attached garage in his home. He had agoraphobia, panic disorder with agoraphobia. He went to see this psychiatrist, who really, over a period of about a year, year and a half, helped him enormously with medication and psychotherapy. And over the next year or so, because he was going on a once-monthly basis, this psychiatrist began to, in a sense, unload some of his difficulties onto the patient, which the patient found a little bit strange, but at the same time, because of a phenomenon that you, of course, know, known as transference, he thought this was fabulous. He was helping the psychiatrist and getting into good graces with him. And one thing led to another, at one point, the psychiatrist said, "I'm having trouble with a former patient of mine, a woman.
Uh-oh.
She's accused me of, and she is suing me. She says that I was interacting with her in a sexually inappropriate way, and I don't know what to do." And he ended up sort of counseling, counseling the psychiatrist. A long story short, what happens then is that about 3 or 4 months later, the psychiatrist visits the patient at his home. He shows up one evening and he makes a proposition. He says, "I'd like to go into business with you, and we can." This fellow was in the motorcycle repair business, they were going to go into they were going to do a joint kind of thing. And this was further strange. Yeah. It was very strange to him. But then the psychiatrist said, "Look, I know you're a guy who knows other guys from the streets.
Uh-oh.
Would you be able to get me a gun?"
Oh, no.
Yeah. And again, one thing led to another, and the patient got so frightened that he went to the police.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And he told them what was going on, and the police had him wear a wire. And lo and behold, the psychiatrist was sucking the patient into a conspiracy whereby he was going to help him obtain a pistol with ammunition.
Right.
And he was going to invite 6 people whom he knew to dinner at the psychiatrist's house.
Oh,
and the psychiatrist was going to shoot them all, hack them up.
Wow.
And he had asked the patient if he knew anything about sharks and chum, and could he possibly get him or rent him a boat. They were going to go out. He was going to go out to Long Island Sound and dump the various body parts. But he needed a gun to do this. So what happened was, this was all set up. They were going to meet this fellow who could provide a gun at a Home Depot parking lot.
And
the psychiatrist wanted the patient to accompany him in his car, and he did so, and he was scared to death. Oh. And, of course, the fellow who entered the car and was going to sell the gun to the psychiatrist was an undercover police officer, and they arrested the psychiatrist, and he was put up on criminal charges and indicted. And at the same time, the patient became absolutely distressed, and he could never go into therapy again, and his panic symptoms all returned, and he was suing the psychiatrist for the inappropriate behavior and the inappropriate relationship that he had engendered. And it was the strangest thing, and so that's one of the strangest cases I ever encountered. Yes. The question I was asked to answer was the easiest one I've ever been asked in my life. Doctor, is it your professional opinion, with a reasonable degree of medical and psychiatric certainty, that Dr. So-and-so departed from standard and accepted medical and psychiatric procedures in his treatment of Mr. So-and-so? and you know, it was pretty easy. There was no cross-examination.
Right. And your answer was, you think?
Right? But it was a classic case of an absolute abuse of the transference.
Oh, yes.
And of the psychiatrist sucking in this really pathetic guy into a scheme, into a conspiratorial plot.
Sure.
And thankfully, he was wise enough to go to the police and not get further involved. Because transference, as you know, people do all kinds of things because of transference.
They
can be sucked into criminality.
The other crazy case was
in a psychiatric emergency room. I was in the hospital in the emergency room, and I saw this fellow walking by in a long white coat. I saw him go by 2-3 days in a row.
Huh.
And he had a stethoscope, as the doctors often do. He had it slung around his neck with the white coat.
Sure.
And on a third or fourth day, there's a knock on my office door, and the guy comes in and with his very distinguished British accent says, "Is it okay with you, doctor, if I sit in on your next psychiatric evaluation?" And I look at him and I say, "Well, I've seen you here a few days in a row. Who are you?" And I see stitched on his white lab coat is Dr. Boris Papalini.
Okay.
Boris Papalini. It's a Russian given name and
right.
Either an Italian or some other name. His surname.
Right.
So I said, "Well, yeah, there's no problem, but let's talk a little bit first."
Yes.
And we're talking, and I had a strange feeling about him, and I don't know why. I asked him a couple of questions. I said, "What are you doing in the G building, which was the psychiatric building?" He
yes.
said, "Well, I'm here to see I'm on a consultation." I said, "What kind?" "A neurological consultation." So I asked him a neurological question.
Uh-oh.
A very loaded one, and he didn't know what I was talking about. So I knew at that moment that this guy was not a neurologist. I couldn't quite understand. So I went up to the receptionist, and I said, "Can you go through the computer files and see if there's a physician on staff named Boris Papalini?" And she said, "Yes, there is. He's in neonatal hematology."
Oh my God.
So I say, "Well, this guy is no neonatal hematologist. He alleges that he's a..." So I go into the office with two huge,
yes,
gigantic security guards.
Yes.
And I ask him, "Dr. Papalini, can you tell me where you went to medical school?"
Yes.
And he fumfers and he hems and he haws. Bottom line, I see something in his pocket. It's bulging. And I say, "My God, what does this guy have? A pistol in there?" And I indicate to the two guards, they grab him by each arm and they hold him. And he starts protesting. He's going to sue. He's this, that, the other thing. And lo and behold, he says, "I'm here for a consultation." And I said, "You're not a neurologist." He said, "I am. As a matter of fact, I have my consultant with me." I said, "Your consultant?"
No.
He said, "Yes." And he looks down at his pocket, and at that moment, I see a hamster pokes its head out of the guy's pocket.
Oh, my God.
And he was a paranoid schizophrenic who, believe it or not, was wandering around the hospital for days on end. He'd gone down to the lawn. You know, a hospital such as Kings County Hospital in New York is a huge conglomerate of buildings. Thousands of patients, floral deliveries, food deliveries, linen services, patients and visitors coming in and out, doctors, lawyers, you name it. It's like a small city.
Yes.
And this guy had gone in and he had gotten a white coat out of a laundry bin and he put it on, and he somehow or other he got a hold of a stethoscope and he was going around examining patients.
God bless him.
Yeah.
Breaks my heart.
And the danger of it, the really striking thing was that only a few years later, a woman physician was murdered in the hospital by someone who had done a similar, not this man, someone who had done the same thing, not by the presumed doctor, the ersatz Boris Papalini, but someone else. He had been living in a halfway house. He had gone into the hospital. He was sleeping on the top floor near the roof where they stored old x-ray machines, and he was eating food off cafeteria trays that had been discarded.
Oh my goodness.
And he grabbed the white coat, and he went up to this, he was wandering around the hospital, he went into this woman's office, she was alone, he raped and killed her, and he went back to the halfway house, and two people in the halfway house discovered the woman's pocketbook and with its ID and all of that, her license and so forth in there, and they reported it to the police, and he was captured. So after that is when security became absolutely ironclad in all New York City hospitals. You have to show all kinds of identification before you go in.
Yes. You know, same here in the Los Angeles hospitals as well. We have
So, you know, these are people in extremis. These are stories that are beyond the realm,
fascinating. They are fascinating stories, and I love reading your books because you do share and you do take some of your, you know, nonfiction or fiction books rather. You do take some of the stories from real life, which are amazing. You know, so interesting. And guys, if you just tuned in today, I have one of my favorite guest experts, authors, and also psychiatrists. He's been there, done that, and is still doing it all, writing and practicing. And it's Mark Rubenstein. And also, he's written, let's see, how many books are we looking at now? Seven? Eight?
Well, total, it was fiction and nonfiction. It's 14 now, soon to be 16.
Shame on me.
We have one coming out in October and then two more coming out a year apart after that. And the one coming out in October is called The Storytellers, straight talk from the planet's most popular authors. And it's based on my interviews for the Huffington Post of people like Harlan Coben, Jonathan Kellerman, Lisa Gardner, Tess Gerritsen, you know, some of the David Mamet, some of the best-known writers on the planet.
And it
was like a workshop in creativity to speak with these people. These are the Huffington Post interviews. That's coming out in October. So I think it's 14 now, and it's going up. And, you know, it's fun. It's such great fun.
Well, you're such a good writer, and I can tell it's fun for you because you just the books just flow, and they're fascinating, all the stories. So when you were talking about the last doctor, the supposed doctor who was a psychiatric patient, you know, I thought you were going to a similar story, such as Catch Me If You Can, guy who Leonardo DiCaprio played in that film, where he was a master of disguise and learned just enough to fake people. And I've always been fascinated, I think, as you know, with the bad guys and some of the villains in your novels. So what my fascination has been, and you've helped me understand this in the past, but I just like to throw this out there again, if you don't mind, is talking about, you know, the so-called bad guys and the villains in your novels. And I'm always interested, I know it rationally, but there's still a line that I can't quite get to. Can you explain the difference between someone diagnosed with psychosis, a bipolar one, let's just say, who has an identifiable chemical imbalance, which causes them to have those audio or visual hallucinations, to harm someone? You know, that person is the devil, and so you are assigned to eliminate them in any way you can. Or the voice is telling them that, you know, they're hated by certain people, and they can't help themselves because they've gone off their medications, or I either have not ever had their meds, as opposed to an individual who's defined as a psychopath or an antisocial personality disorder. There's a fine line between that, but how do you differentiate between the two?
Well, you really hit the nail on the head when you said, you know, the former, namely the person with a severe psychotic mental disorder, as you said, can't help himself. These are people who, for the most part, appear to have some kind of chemical or neurobiological imbalance or disorder, and by definition, the term psychosis means they've lost touch with reality. They don't see things in the real world the way other people do. So people may ask, well, how do you define reality? Reality is essentially defined by what we term consensual validation.
Yes.
If four of us are standing in a room and only one of us sees a face on the wall and that face is talking to that person, the other three don't see it, that person lacks consensual validation, and that person is psychotic. The other three are operating within the realm of consensual validation in the reality of the world. Psychotic people, schizophrenics, and when they are in a truly manic phase or a profoundly depressed phase, they are not in control and they don't see the world in realistic terms. They are having either auditory hallucinations, that is hearing voices, or they're seeing visions, or they're filled with a sense of energy and absolutely unbridled sense of themselves as being able to do anything. They can cook 75 steaks in you know, 10 hours. Or I once saw a patient who went out and bought tons and tons of furniture on money she didn't have, and when they tried to deliver the furniture, they couldn't get it through the doorway, so she called a contractor to have the contractor come and cut down the doorway and widen it so they could get the furniture in. Thankfully, neighbors and relatives were able to stop her and get her hospitalized, but she'd run up $35,000 in credit card debt. But these are psychotic people, and they are operating beyond the realm. As opposed to someone who's considered to be a psychopath or an antisocial personality, these are people who know reality, who have not lost touch with reality, but for reasons that may have some genetic basis, but by and large are viewed as having more of an environmental contribution, are people who love to live on the edge, who have very little, if any, conscience about what they do to other people. They are fairly incapable of feeling remorse. They're people who want what they want, when they want it, and they will stop at nothing to get it. And that description pretty much characterizes a very large percentage of confirmed criminals, people who repeatedly end up harming other people, feeling no remorse, going out and doing it again, all for their own profit or aggrandizement, and who really have no capacity for empathy or ability to realize how others may feel, and so they constitute a subsection of people who, again, we label psychopaths or antisocial personalities. They tend to have very superficial social relationships. They're pretty much, I think, incapable of deep, profound feelings of love or empathy. And as I said, they constitute the majority of people who would fall into the class of criminals. I'm talking hardcore criminals, not people who've done soft crimes and who are locked away for, let's say, possession of marijuana or whatever. And so there's a vast difference between these two categories of illness. Unfortunately, many schizophrenics are locked away in our penal institutions because they have done things that have broken the law, but they did them while in the throes of their madness, and they couldn't control themselves, and they had really no responsibility, in a sense. And you know, that's where you can get into the the whole business of NGRI, not guilty by reason of insanity, which, by the way, is very rarely claimed, and only 0.25% of those who do claim NGRI succeed in that kind of a pleading.
Wow, fascinating. You wouldn't know it by the programs we see, you know, on television, those
You'd think that, you know, this is an everyday thing. It's not. I mean, there are the people who, you know, such as, what's his name? He was the fellow who shot Ronald Reagan. I've forgotten his name.
You and I are both in blank zone.
But,
right now.
You know, he spent about 25, 27 years, I forget, in Bethesda in a mental institution, and only within the last year or so he's been let out to live with his mother under very controlled circumstances. What most people don't know, by the way, about NGRI is that even if it does succeed, people have a tendency to say, oh, he got away with it, he claimed insanity. You don't get away with the crime if if you are considered NGRI, not guilty by reason of insanity. You're called an acquittee, and you're put in a state mental hospital, which a criminal mental, a hospital for the criminally insane is what they used to be called. These hospitals are under the aegis of the Department of Corrections in pretty much every state. And you are held there indefinitely until, quote unquote, as the law would put it, restoration of sanity has been achieved. Well, PSRB, a psychiatric services review board, reviews the case once a year and involves social workers and psychiatrists and psychologists and people who've had intimate contact with the acquittee over the last year. And they reevaluate the patient. It's as It's more difficult than even the person like Sirhan, who wants parole, and
right.
he's been in prison for decades now,
right.
and every year he's turned down. It's the same with the PSRB for those who are acquittees.
Right.
They
right.
hardly ever get out, and if they do, it's when they're so much older that they pose virtually no threat to anyone
right.
in society.
Sure. They're physically incapable, possibly, of carrying.
But you can see the difficulties and the problems and conundrums
yes.
when you get into forensic psychiatry, both civil and criminal. I think in one of the books in Bedlam's Door or Beyond Bedlam's Door,
yeah.
I talk about certain attorneys who wanted me to shade a case to suit their purposes
mm-hmm.
so that the claimant would make more money or the plaintiff, and of course they would take their one third, and you know, lawyers on both sides of the aisle would occasionally push to try and get an expert to shade his or her findings
yes.
and tilt the scales one way or the other. And you
yes.
know, it's there too in the forensic arena. I always likened it to modern day gladiatorial combat. I mean, you know,
<That's true. laughs>
you're involved. I mean, sometimes millions of dollars
oh,
are
God,
at stake,
yes. Yes.
and these people will go at it tooth and nail, and
yes.
they will do anything and everything to try and get the jury to be swayed in their direction.
Mm-hmm.
And let's face it, a court trial, a courtroom trial, whether it's criminal or civil, is a play. It's
right.
drama.
It's
all put on for the sake of the trier of fact, namely the jury.
It is.
And I spent a lot of time in Bedlam's Door with the forensic end of things because
yes. mm-hmm.
they are the dramatic. They are one of the 8 million stories, you know, in the Naked
right.
City.
That's
right. I always found them fascinating.
Well, all of your books are fascinating, and we're just out of time, as we always are, so quickly.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Listen, thank you so much for being on the show today.
I fear I talked too much.
Oh, I love it when you talk. It's just, you know, you're just so interesting. I just want to kind of take in everything that you're telling all the listeners, and I always learn myself as well. So thank you so much, as always, for being such a wonderful guest. And
thank you for having me.
Oh,
it's a pleasure, really.
Good. Well, good. I'm so glad. And listen, where can the listeners get more information about you and get your 14 books that are so good?
Okay, well, my website is Mark Rubenstein, that's MarkRubenstein,
mm-hmm.
-author.com.
Perfect.
And, you know, frankly, the easiest way to get the books, although they are in bookstores,
yeah.
the easiest way is on Amazon. They never run out, and they don't have to worry about shelf space.
Yeah.
And the books are available, and it's the cheapest way also. I mean, not just the e-books, but also the paperbacks are
yes.
far less expensive than they would be in most bookstores.
Wow.
And that's where, you know, if people
yeah.
are interested,
sure.
I think people who enjoy your show would love Bedlam's Door and
oh,
Beyond
yeah.
Bedlam's Door.
I
think they'd find them very interesting because they are stories
mm-hmm.
and they are psychiatric, psychological, but above all, they're human.
Yes, exactly. Well said. Thank you so much again for being such a terrific guest. And
thanks for having me.
And we'll talk soon.
Okay.
All right.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye. All righty. Again, that's Dr. Mark Rubenstein. He's done it all. He's a marvelous psychiatrist with his own practice, of course, forensic psychiatrist, taught psychiatric residents, intern psychologist at New York Presbyterian Hospital, assistant professor at Cornell University's Medical School, and of course has written so many amazing psychiatric novels, fiction, nonfiction, everything you can get your hands on. You're going to learn from Mark Rubenstein's books. They're just amazing. Yeah, we are out of time. My goodness. Thank you so much for listening, everybody. As I always say, do take care of yourself first. And then you'll be great for other people. See, then you can give. And that's what that's all about here in society. I'll be back next week. We're going to enter into a zone of a love story that went bad. Basically, all of our stories that we've ever had. We've all had it. But anyway, I'll be back next week here on the couch on LATalkRadio.com. This is Dr. Michelle Cohen. Bye-bye.